Good afternoon and welcome to the bi-weekly briefing on COVID-19 that's hosted by the MMA platform, but provided to all of you by the Baker-Polito administration. We are deeply grateful to the partnership that the Lieutenant Governor and Governor have forged with cities and towns throughout their entire administration, but certainly during this pandemic, the public health emergency. This briefing is intended to give you the latest information to answer your questions. As always, we will be posting a summary of this briefing on the MMA website, along with an audio recording for those who are unable to attend in real time. We appreciate all of you participating, asking your questions, and working so closely with the administration in battling this public health emergency. This is the 21st a special briefing that the administration is hosting in partnership with the MMA. And Lieutenant Governor, we deeply appreciate all that you're doing for all of us. And now I turn the floor over to you for your briefing.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I hope that you are all doing well. You certainly have a lot on your plates, and we just wanted another opportunity, being the 21st one, to get together. And you have our all-star lineup, from Russell Johnson over at DESE, to answer a number of questions you might have around learning in your community and school reopening, as well as the at-home learning that is happening or in some other venues within your community. And he can get into those details with you. And we also have our DPH team, Dr. Larry Madoff and Jana Ferguson, to talk about COVID-related questions that you might have. And always reliable Division of Local Services, John Cronin is here to talk about some of the things that you're working on, sorting through COVID relief funds, and certainly the upcoming round to be able to talk about how we're going to work with you there. Let me just start with reopening. Last week, we made an adjustment to dining outdoors. When we initially extended that executive order, there was a time frame through November 1st. That time frame obviously is approaching very quickly, and the outdoor experience has been a pretty good experience across the Commonwealth. With colder temperatures, we wonder how that will be in the upcoming months, but in any event, we've received requests to extend the outdoor dining operations, and the governor has done that to a date in the future, which would be 60 days after the end of the state of emergency. So from our viewpoint, that is a very long time from this moment, but it will at least give restaurants something to work with. Outdoor areas that are tented, for instance, the flaps can go down. You need to work with your local boards of health relative to that area and how it is heated. That's an issue that local boards of health and public safety on the local level are working through. So just be mindful of what that might entail. We also extended an order regarding indoor and outdoor gaming arcades. So you have guidance there as well. Later this afternoon, your local boards of health will receive additional information at your weekly briefing. And it will provide you with information regarding bar seating at restaurants. So many of you know, when we started the indoor dining, we did not allow for any seating at bar or service at a bar, worried about the gathering of people standing closely together. What we are reviewing with you this afternoon is seating, so at the bar for dining purposes, so long as the protocol is addressed, which would require a physical barrier, like a plexiglass between the bar top and the other side of the bar, and 6 feet of distance between the parties seated at the bar for a meal. So you'll have to look into that. It will not be effective until the 28th of September, even though it's being released today. So that gives you and your boards of health some time to think about that and work with your restaurants. We've heard a lot about menus. There are many opportunities for people use to gain insight into what a restaurant is offering. And reusable menus will make a comeback. So that is also going to be part of the update later. And increasing a seating at a table from 6 people to 10 people. So I just want to give you a little preview of that. We're also making adjustments relative to beverage stations. For instance, at your local convenience store, if there's a beverage station that has been closed, that can now reopen under a certain protocol. So you'll be seeing that. And again, giving you time to make these adjustments, the effectiveness of these measures will be on Monday, September 28th. Also, just a reminder, working alongside of Speaker DeLeo and Senate President Spilka, we've extended the deferral of regular sales tax, meals tax, and room occupancy tax for small business due from March 2020 through April 2021, so that they will instead be due in May of 2021. With regard to college and university, COVID-19 matters. Many of you know that, as Mr. Cronin, you noted, you have students in college and they're thankfully still there, but the colleges and universities have had to work very closely here in Massachusetts with our agencies to meet certain planning and protocols, including a testing strategy. Our department has reviewed these plans, and as you can see, colleges have resumed service in many areas. The weekly report, because now that this activity is open, we want to measure what's happening in these areas, and the best way to do that is through data and through the results that we gain from these campuses around testing. So our new report on test results from colleges and universities was introduced this last Wednesday, and it does allow for a better insight in terms of what those numbers look like. So you can read that in the report. About 60 colleges are reporting to DPH. It's worth noting that last week's initial report indicated that about 500,000 tests have been conducted as part of testing at higher education institutions since August 15th, and only about 500 positive results have been reported from those tests. So that's a good indication of what's going on, and the results from the colleges are included in our daily numbers. That's a positive rate that's well below the statewide average, and our statewide positive rate is below 1%, averaging 0.08. We'll continue to monitor that. We can all see what's happening in other places in the country and around the world. So as we enter this fall season, temperatures getting colder, you have flu and cold season upon us. It's encouraged for everyone to look at a flu vaccine, as well as a mandate for students of K through 12, and as well as colleges. And of course, the certain exemptions still apply for religious and medical purposes. And then we will just need to monitor, as you would expect, the symptoms that might feel like the same regardless if it's a cold or flu or COVID, and that's the tricky part. So we'll all work together as we move forward. On grants, I know that many of you receive the notices through our Community Compact program and the website that updates these grants, but just to highlight a few, the Site Readiness Program opened its fifth round. It's a $3 million grant program. Applications are due for this program on November 12th. The IT grant program is open now, and applications are due through October 15th. And the Shared Streets and Spaces grant, applications are due today. So I just wanted to remind you of that. There will be another round of food security grants as well to be announced. I just wanted to thank you for your partnership and just make sure that you're taking advantage of these programs while managing through COVID and related matters. With that, I'm now going to turn it over to Russell Johnston.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Always a pleasure to be here with this prestigious group of mayors and town managers. Really excited to talk to you about what's going on as we reopen schools, and just beginning with a note of gratitude for everything that you have done to bring our students back, to have them in front of our teachers as much in person as possible, remotely where necessary. My own son attends public school here in Massachusetts, and it's great to hear him learning from his teachers, being back in front of in a virtual classroom right now. And so again, just hats off to all of you for all that you've done. So what I've presented to you before, and I really just kind of want to keep updating the narrative of where we are in our efforts to reopen schools. And I think the big headline from DESE is we are at a point now that's very important, that we're moving away from developing guidance to moving more towards targeted assistance. And so over the summer, as you know, we produced a wide variety of guidance documents, over 25 documents, more than 200 pages. And I know that there have been some criticism of like, that felt like a lot. At the same time, I would counter that by saying it is a lot for us to do this work, and we need to be very specific and precise about all the actions that we're taking. And so everything from how to safely transport students to clean and sanitize classrooms to knowing what to do if we have symptomatic individuals in our schools, all needed very specific language, and we've developed that and produced it. What we're doing right now is we're actually compiling all of the guidance documents into a compendium, and this will be available on our website soon. And so as we kind of close the chapter on guidance documents, what I want you to know today is that we are combining them all into one searchable compendium so that people don't have to look around for the information that they might need at this point. Certain topics are mentioned in multiple guidance documents, and so we want it to be easily referenced and easily searched so that you can find what you need and then update it as necessary. We work really closely. I'm so pleased to be on this in this meeting today with my very esteemed colleagues from DPH. And as we work together to update any of the guidance documents, we will make sure that we note that in the compendium so people can see what has changed since our previous versions. But as we kind of move beyond guidance documents, we're really squarely in the space right now of targeted assistance. And we are doing that in kind of large and small ways. Some of the things we're doing make headlines and are maybe widely known, others maybe not so much. And so I'm kind of glad to give you a rundown today of a lot of the things that we have going on. First of all, we did quite a bit to support teachers during those 10 days of professional development before school began by offering professional development free of charge to districts to help to make sure that the curriculum that we can deliver in modified ways this year is as robust as possible. We are also working right now, very importantly, I think, to support school nurses. The role of the school nurse has vastly changed. And if we don't have school safety, we don't have school. And so my team and I are teaming up with DPH, and we're meeting with nurses from all across the state this month and next month to answer their questions about reopening, to really support their pivotal role in schools in providing safe learning environments for students. And it's really been a pleasure to work with them to hear their voice at this important time. We're also working with school psychologists because there's quite a backlog of assessments related to understanding whether or not children have disabilities. And so today we are offering a free remote assessment teleseminar for school psychologists from across the state. We're recording it so it's available after today's session so that we really get the word out about how can we evaluate students reliably, with validity, but also safely. And so glad to bring that knowledge and expertise to our school psychologists. Some of the ways that, another way that we have not put out as publicly is communication tools that we've provided to schools and districts. We hired a third-party firm, a partner firm, to work with us to kind of do qualitative assessment on what parents in Massachusetts need to hear from school districts about school reopening. What are those key messages that really help to stick in parents' minds about what they will feel reassured by about sending their children back to school? What are their concerns? So what do school and district leaders need to be messaging right now so that it truly resonates with parents? And so we actually pulled that research together with our partner firm, our partner organization, and we coupled that, I think very importantly, with letters that use that language that can be sample letters to provide to families. And those letters run the gamut from a welcome back letter with those key messages that we know parents that really resonate with parents and hopefully reassure parents, as well as letters that help to explain if there's a positive case of COVID within a school. That's language that none of us are used to having before. We want to make sure that, you know, a superintendent or a school leader isn't using words like outbreak, when in fact they really mean a single case of COVID. And so by having sample letters at school and district leaders' fingertips, by knowing what this research says, we hope that we are providing resources that will help schools and districts connect much better and more robustly with parents as we start this new school year. So I think those are some of the things that have happened behind the scenes that I would want you to know about. We did not publish those communication tools on our website because communication really needs to be trusted. And we felt like the most trusted source is the local source. We want schools and districts to customize those letters, to tailor them to their unique circumstances in their communities. So we didn't put it on DESE's website. We don't want to take credit for it. We want schools and districts to really strengthen that very important and frankly intimate relationship that they need to have with families, so that the trust can be there for sending their children back to school. The things that have been more public that I just want to mention that are on our website in particular, and that we want kind of the larger community, school stakeholder community to know about, are a few key things. First of all, we have set up through collaboration with the Department of Public Health and the Executive Office of Health and Human Services, we have set up a mobile testing unit that can be available when required in order to understand and ascertain if there has been the transmission of cases from within a school. And so if we have, for example, an initial case of a student in a classroom and then maybe a teacher test positive in the same classroom, there might be concern, and understandably, that there's been transmission perhaps in that school. And so what we're asking for is a really close team up and coordination between the local Board of Health and the school department in order to name a point of contact who will reach out to the Department of Public Health and share the information about the number of cases that might be occurring within a building and seek DPH's input about whether or not transmission has likely occurred and if the mobile testing unit is needed. And so you as mayors, what I would just really appreciate you knowing about this and doing about this is just to make sure that the school department and the local Board of Health are having those conversations now about how will they share information? How will they know about positive cases in schools? Because they both have unique sources of information that they need to bring together. And so it's my hope that, you know, maybe if you can draw them together to make sure they're having those conversations, we can be more confident and ready when those moments occur, because those are going to be very high stress moments if we think that we have multiple cases from within a building. And the better preparation that we can do now, the better readiness we'll have and confidence, frankly, that we'll have when those moments occur. So we'd just appreciate if you could look into that. The memo is on our website. It's dated September 11th. We'd be glad to share any resources with you after this meeting as well that might be helpful. But that's one key component. The next that I want to mention is that we are asking schools and districts to report positive cases to us. We think this is important for a couple of reasons. One, it's important that DESE, in its role of creating guidance for the state, knows the extent to which cases are occurring. If we don't have this information, we could be very flat-footed in what we are asking of schools and districts. We really need to know what their experience of COVID is for our own policymaking. But even more importantly, we want to be able to gather this information from you by having school and district leaders or nurses, some point of contact, some point person, report these cases to us, because we also want to provide technical assistance at this really important time. We might move this system online so that the cases could just be reported electronically. But for right now, we just know how important it is that if someone is facing a positive case in a school, that they can talk to a live person here at DESE and work through the protocols. Talk about the cleaning that they might need to do, the quarantining that they need to recommend or work with their local Board of Health on, and really hear from us maybe some reassurance that they're doing the right things, or answer questions that they might have. And frankly, if they have no questions, then we can quickly take the information and move on, not to take up any more of their time than we need to. So that system is up and running. We're very pleased that we're getting calls every day now from schools and districts about this, just to kind of, hear what's going on. Limited cases so far, but kind of a consistent outreach. And we have a team set up who can take calls from 7 a.m. until 6 p.m. Then after hours, we have a member on call to be able to assist school districts, because we really want to be there for them when they are facing these issues. And really things like the mobile testing unit, the reporting of cases to us, these are all very much in service of keeping our schools open. We just know how important it is to maintain these really, you know, frankly, sacred interactions between teachers and students. And the more that we can do by having a mobile testing unit, providing technical assistance on the spot as there are positive cases, the more that we can do to just make sure that we maintain that critical connection between teachers and students as we begin the school year. And the final thing that I'll mention that has made some headlines is that we have also identified 16 districts that have, and I'm sure there are maybe some mayors of these communities on the phone right now, in this meeting right now, that you know we identified as consistently being designated as green on the weekly health metric from the Department of Public Health, and really you know requesting them to tell us what they're doing to provide in-person services for students in their districts. And we are not taking this as a, you know, we're not approaching this as a from a punitive measure, but really a measure to say, let's work from data. The data are telling us that we can have students in front of teachers, that we should. And so let's make every effort that we can to move towards that and to identify ways in which we can, you know, frankly, from the information that we'll get back from school committees in response to our request for information, we want to know how we can continue to help you move in that direction. Or, you know, if necessary, provide some sort of feedback on through, you know, an auditing or accountability measure of saying, this is what we actually need you to do if you aren't taking those steps yourselves. And again, we do this truly from the belief that in-person learning is the strongest form of learning for our students in the state. Again, as the state director of special education, I can just tell you firsthand just how important it is that we have a lot of our, you know, our really most vulnerable students especially need this. And so every effort that we're making to get our students in front of our teachers, to get our students together in classrooms, to really strengthen that social emotional bond that they have with each other and with their teacher is really what we find so critical. And we're just so fortunate that we're in a place in our state where the mitigation strategies that the Baker-Polito administration has really put into effect, they are working, and we do have low rates of transmission right now. And so we do have this ability to ask for in-person learning. And so, you know, I just really hope that we can all get behind it and push, because it's what our children need. And I really appreciate my time with you. Glad to answer any questions you might have or fill in any other areas that I haven't addressed so far.
Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner. Lieutenant Governor, do you want to have Sean give a brief update and then take all the questions, or do specific education questions now?
Why don't we do Sean next, and then we'll go back to Russell to address education questions, and then we can all address whatever comes up in the chat.
That's perfect. Thank you. Sean Cronin.
Sure. So just two things pretty quickly. The first thing, as Lieutenant Governor mentioned earlier, we will be announcing round two of the Coronavirus Relief Fund program. Hopefully within another week or so, still working with ANF on finalizing that, but it will be much sooner rather than later. Again, hopefully within another week or so. And related to that, tentatively, and I underscore that, next Thursday at 1, with the assistance of MMA, we're going to have a Zoom call similar to the one we did back in, I think it was April, when the first round opened up. To go through and explain the guidance, which will be issued in advance of that, because it's obviously a little bit different than round one. So we want to make sure that everybody understands the process, the reporting requirements, et cetera. So MMA will be sending something out once it's finalized, but we hope to have that sometime next week and then have round two open up right after that. So keep an eye out for that. And then the second thing is, both personally and then DLS as a whole, we've gotten some questions, great questions from managers and mayors about not having official cherry sheets. And what does that mean for when it's time to set the tax rate? You know, I had one manager ask, do we have to use the number that was part of the agreement for Chapter 70 in UGA? And the answer really is no, because there's no... not all of the local aid pieces finalized yet. So, you know, that manager who asked me said, but what if I use a number that's lower than those two numbers The answer was, you'll be able to do that if you set your budget back in the spring using lower numbers. And if you want to be conservative and, you know, sit on that budget capacity, you can do that. Because normally everybody knows that you have to use the final cherry sheet numbers, both the assessment side and the aid side, when you set your tax rate. Well, since we don't have a complete cherry sheet, there's going to be some, you know, going back and forth about the number. So if you have any questions about it, or if your town accountant or city auditor has any questions about it, just ask the field rep that your community has from DLS. So like many things in life right now, this is very different. The situation hasn't come up in this type of environment where we just don't have a cherry sheet. And we all know that most of you will be going back to town meetings in the fall and going to council meetings in the fall as well to make final budget amendments if you choose to do so based upon the agreement between the governor and the legislature. So if you have any questions on that, you know, shoot off an email to me or just have your finance folks check with their field rep. So just want to highlight that because we have gotten that question more and more as the weeks go on here. And then I did see in the chat, Lisa, I'll get you an answer to that question about a delay in small bridge reimbursement. If it's a delay and the state ends, we're not going to hit you for free cash. I can promise you that right now, but I'll look into that. So that's it on my end.
So that will be October 1st, will be the webinar on the second round of the Coronavirus Relief Fund.
Tentatively, yeah, we hope. It's just ANF and MMA, we just got to finalize on the date and on the guidance that we're going to be providing.
Then MMA will send out to all the municipal CEOs, everyone who's invited to this call, notice and the Zoom link. There was a question at the end about whether or not boards of health could be looped in to that CARES Act briefing. MMA does not necessarily have the email address for boards of health, so that would just be an option for the municipal official to share that registration link and have the Board of Health individuals do it if a community wants to have people sign on to that. Great. Thank you very much. There are some questions. We'll take those after the education ones. Lieutenant Governor, do you want to have us start to cycle through the education questions?
Yes, that would be great.
Let's see. Wedding. Well, there are some broader public health ones. Here's a question. Will positive reporting also be required of the municipally approved exempted remote learning facilities and those other places where they're taking students in doing remote learning someplace other than the home?
Thank you. Actually, and the answer to that is a simple yes. We want to know about all students. And so even if a student is learning remotely, we want to know about the student experience in Massachusetts, the teacher experience in Massachusetts. And so it's an easy yes.
And then we also have, and again, a reminder to people who have questions to just type them into the chat function and we go through as best we can. Unanswered questions are shared back with the administration and we work to answer those in the notice for the next briefing plus in our summary article on the website. The question is, there's a comment actually from a municipality that says, for example, one community, this community's Pittsfield is remote because the local teachers union supported by the MTA refused to open in person. Presumably Pittsfield is likely a green community and fits in the category that you were talking about, Assistant Commissioner Johnston. Any comment on that?
You know, I appreciate the question and the comment that our thinking on that is to the greatest extent possible to then commit to, you know, what we would hope for Pittsfield or other communities like this is that you committed to a short-term MOU. If you've made a commitment in writing with your teachers association that is for a limited amount of time that gives you a chance to come back to the table. And frankly, you know, we want to work with you. We want to apply pressure where we can to kind of bring the parties together as best as possible to say that this is our expectation. How can we get this done? So again, I hope that the parties will be back at the table soon. in Pittsfield and other like communities to reassess where you are, to look at the data that might be more available now than it was when you were initially meeting, and to work with all effort to get students back in front of their teachers in person in that, those types of communities.
Thank you. Another question for you. We have some parents raising issues about our out of district placements and a number of hours of in-person learning and difficulties of remote learning. Could you address the status of those particular questions about?
Certainly. So we have actually, our guidance to all schools, public and approved special education schools and collaboratives, has been that we need to make sure that we are fulfilling the obligations of students' IEPs. And in some cases that might be provided remotely. We have collected data from the approved special education schools, and by and large, they're actually to a very high percentage providing in-person services, but there are some that aren't. And in those cases, we would really want special ed directors and the directors of the approved special education schools to be working together to ensure that all aspects of the student's IEP are being implemented, even if it has to be done remotely. A lot of these same challenges are also true on the public school side as we provide services that are not, that have to be provided differently. At the end of the day, what we're expecting right now is that all parents have direct communication, individualized communication with their school department, with their child's teacher or IEP liaison about how special ed services will be provided differently, and for that to be documented. And the documentation to be shared with the district. And that's really a place where districts can play a role with the approved special education schools to say, do we all agree that this is truly the child's entitlement to special education as described in this learning plan that we call it. So that communication that needs to be documented is, I think, the best avenue for ensuring that we're all in agreement that what is being described as services by the approved special education school truly meets the child's needs.
A comment from a former mayor, now a town manager. My sixth grader woke up this morning and said, "I don't want to sit on mute in a Zoom class. I want to go to school." This was quite a welcome surprise to his mother and me. Thank you and Commissioner Riley for the letter encouraging my school district and unshaded, gray community to get back to school. Is this question? Yes, how often do monitoring visits need to take place after the initial inspection by the municipal approving authority under the remote learning enrichment program? Communities essentially make the visit, they certify to EEC that the entity is eligible to be essentially to operate in an unlicensed manner. But then the guidance that was issued says that communities also have an obligation to monitor in an ongoing way. Do you have a frequency? Any more specifics about that requirement?
Thanks, Jeff. Actually, I don't myself, but I can look into this and get back to you.
Great. We'll then share that answer in our summary story. If not in the first update, then when we receive it, we'll provide that answer. And we anticipate that as more and more communities take a look at these remote learning enrichment programs, that more questions will come up. That it's probably been a relatively slow starting process just because it's a whole new activity. That completes the education questions so far. So we'll go back up to the top of the chat, and then we'll take general reopening questions, some finance or budget issues, or general public health questions. The first question was, knowing that the physical and density characteristics of each community can be different, has any guidance been provided or thought of concerning house to house trick-or-treating or other kinds of Halloween events? And we also had another question about whether or not there's some state guidance on Halloween as well.
I'm sure everyone on this call agrees that none of us want to be in the business of regulating, making decisions about important events like Halloween, but it is important and it does involve youth and families, and it's an activity and a tradition that is long in place. I did speak to Secretary Setters about this, and I believe that she and the DPH team is looking at what other jurisdictions are doing, and we'll be able to provide some guidance soon. Whether it's informal or otherwise, there will be more to come there.
Thank you very much. The sense of urgency will probably increase with every day, so it will be great to receive either formal or informal guidance.
There was an October when it snowed a lot. I don't know which year it was, but it would be actually convenient if it snowed this year. I don't know if we'll be that lucky.
That's right. Wishing for a storm is not something we usually do, but maybe
right. It would be. I know. I'm sure everyone feels the same way. Managing a month of snow seems much easier compared to what we've been managing over the past 6 months.
Absolutely. Right. The next question is on the announcement you made, Lieutenant Governor, regarding changes that will be shared with boards of health later today regarding dining and so on. Will those increases on restaurant spaces and seating be based on community risk level? And I guess a related question to that would be, could communities decide to delay the implementation of those if there are, say, a red or a yellow community and are concerned about having a greater possibility of transmission?
Yeah, these updates apply or are across the state. So it's a statewide change. We have always said if a community wants to act more conservatively than what the guidelines and or protocols are relative to the industry reopening, they certainly can do that. But that these adjustments do apply statewide. They are not made in conjunction with the community risk level. Having said that, we are in the process of reviewing step two of phase three, as many of you know, has not been activated. That includes things like live indoor theater and performances, trampolines, skating, roller skating rinks, things like that. And we have, we're reviewing that as well as the capacity limits and how we stand compared to neighboring states, and also reviewing our gathering order and seeing where we are with that. There have been no decisions made, but there will be more to come in the next couple of weeks.
Thank you. Here's a question about the wedding industry. So presumably this will, as you look at gathering orders and so on, there's a multiple wedding function hall that in a community that's saying that they may go out of business as the colder weather comes and they're not able to have more than 25 people indoors, and just raising a concern about that.
Right, we've heard a lot from facilities that host events. This has been a big challenge for these facilities. There's no question about that. We are in the process, as I've said, reviewing our gathering order and more to come there. There are no decisions made, and there's nothing to report to you today, but I clearly understand the impact of the adjustment that was made in August and what that had on facilities that host or organize events. Generally speaking, we feel when you have an event that's hosted and by a licensed facility, there's more regulation, more sort of eyeballs on the compliance, and there's more monitoring of the activities of the guests. That clearly is a safer venue than one that is unsupervised, unregulated, and really no one monitoring the behavior of the guests, which as we have all seen, more of that kind of activity unsupervised in someone's backyard has contributed to some of the increases in virus spread in community. So we're monitoring all of that, and we'll be making decisions soon, and we'll be sharing that with all of you.
Thank you. Next question has to do with metrics. The question is, are we looking at the correct metrics given the current environment? It seems like with schools and colleges opening, many people who would not otherwise be tested are getting tested now. That's that 500,000 tests in higher education since August. Could this depress the percentage positives for the rest of the population, rendering that metric less useful? So is it more useful now to measure and publicize the number of positives? Just a question about whether or not a very high number of tests is responsible for the seemingly low transmission rate.
Yeah, I'll let the DPH vote speak more to this, but clearly more data is better for everyone. We have aggregated this data so that you can see in the daily, in the dashboard that's released weekly, what college and university testing looks like in the Commonwealth. And those numbers are included in our daily numbers. So that does get to the point that you're making in the chat. But more data is helpful, and any community can understand where the virus spread is taking place in their community, whether it's a nursing home or a private setting or on a college. They clearly have a view into what's happening in their community and can make decisions based upon that. Dr. Madoff, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. I'm impressed by your epidemiology skills. You and the governor have acquired quite a bit of epidemiology during this outbreak. The daily dashboard is now almost 25 pages long. And while the positive test rate is per test, we also report out separately the rate of people. So the percent of positive individuals, which is currently around 2%. So a little higher than the 0.8% of a by test rate, but still quite low. And also just to let folks know that we now lead the country in testing per person, per capita here in Massachusetts, with more testing done per 1,000 residents than any other state. It is true, our colleges and universities are testing at a brisk rate, and that's contributing to the high test rate, but those numbers are broken out weekly, as Lieutenant Governor said, and you can look at rates by town, by on a per person basis also, and so those data are there.
Thank you very much. I haven't quite made it through all 25 pages of each dashboard, but there's so much there. Thank you. Could someone please confirm if the outdoor gathering cap of 50 applies to flea markets? This community's health department has been trying to get a confirmation on this. And then the input they've received from DPH is that flea markets are considered a retail business, and therefore couldn't confirm if the outdoor gathering cap applies. Flea markets do not operate in the same way as a retail business. They don't collect sales taxes. Or many of them don't. The site's not zoned as retail, and they don't have employees. So there's a concern, and a lot of people from outside the area go to the flea markets, and they're gathering together closely in the vendor booths. So there's concern being expressed about flea markets and seeing whether or not it's more of an event as opposed to a retail establishment.
Mm-hmm. The guidance that we've issued treat a flea market as a retail activity, and flea markets and the local Board of Health where the flea market is taking place needs to review the retail guidance relative to the flea market activity within their community. So it is considered a retail activity, needs to follow the retail guidance that we've issued.
So the safety protocols and so on
would have
to be followed. And if they were not, then the Board of Public Health could take action.
That's correct.
Thank you. Here's a question regarding the budget. I hope the answer is no. The given cherry sheets, the cherry sheet situation and the lack of state budget or agreement at the federal level on further aid, should we prepare for 9C cuts this winter?
We and Sean might want to weigh in on this as well. Obviously, we are looking at what you're looking at. There's a lot of talk about what we hope that the federal government will do, but that is unclear and may not be clear until after the election. We continue to monitor the state revenue numbers as you do at the local level, your tax receipts. We have stated that both UGA and Chapter 70 are being held harmless, and that is something that's very important to all of us. And I know that we're in discussions with the legislative leadership to make decisions relative to this year's budget. And as we always do, in October, we begin preparing the next year budget, which is something that we are prepared to do as well. Sean, do you have anything to add?
Just that you know, each community is different with the way they approach budgeting and their levels of conservative revenue estimates. So, you know, that's a local decision that you need to make in terms of planning. But, you know, I echo everything the Lieutenant Governor said in terms of what's going on.
Well, and MMA will put its oar in the water here, and just we deeply appreciate the commitment by Lieutenant Governor Yu and the governor and the legislature regarding providing a statewide increase for Chapter 70 and to provide a hold harmless for all communities in Chapter 70 and to provide for level funding of unrestricted municipal aid. I would make the point that right now it would take an act of the legislature to change the law to authorize the administration to make 9C cuts on either of those two huge accounts, because right now, even under the scenario, and we know that you don't want to do it, but even if you wanted to, the legislature would still have to give you permission. So that appears to be a very unlikely scenario, but there's a lot of other locally derived funds from the state budget that are still up in the air until that budget is set in place. But we're not looking right now. Chapter 70 and unrestricted general government aid are not subject to 9C unless the law has changed. Let's see, another Halloween question. And then let's see. We just had a point made that some great guidance about an hour ago from the CDC regarding Halloween. So we'll have to take a look at that.
Late breaking news.
Yes, exactly.
We'll take a turn at reading that.
We'll see. Although we'll just want to make sure that the CDC keeps it up on its website for more than 24 hours. Let's see. A thank you again. Let's see. That appears to have taken all of the active questions. We've run through them. There are many thank yous to each of the speakers for contributing and providing responses. So Lieutenant Governor, I'll turn it back over to you. Just making a note that if anyone's interested in the CDC guidance, Candace Pierce, MMA's Director of Communications and Membership, has already posted the link at the bottom of the chat. So if you want to go and copy that link now while this webinar is still live, you'll be able to go there after, not during the briefing. And now I'll turn it over back to you, Lieutenant Governor.
Okay, and we will do the same. We'll review the CDC guidance and determine if there's any additional guidance that we need to issue relative to that activity. Again, thank you all to our agency heads for participating and providing some very important clarity and factual information, which you need to rely on locally to make your decisions. And thank you for doing all that you're doing. Again, all of the reinforcements and public messaging and using all of your channels and networks to get the messages out around distancing and face covering and hygiene and all of the rest, because as you can see in other places around the country and the world, there are some upticks, and the more vigilant we are here and the more aggressive we are to manage through the hotter spots, the better off we'll be and making good choices as we live with this virus. At the same time, we need to budget and plan, and we have economic concerns for small business, micro businesses, and this overall economy. We were very pleased that the unemployment numbers dropped to 11%, around that number. And together we get more people back to work, however that work is, and we continue to increase jobs available. We had over 51,000 new jobs added to our economy in Massachusetts in August. So we will continue to work hard on the economic challenges that exist for many individuals in this Commonwealth, as well as look toward the best education possible for our students and helping people live safely here in our Commonwealth. So thank you all. I look forward to the next briefing, but in between there's a lot of information that we can share with each other to help day to day. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor, and to Dr. Madoff. Assistant Commissioner Johnston had to dash off, but we appreciate him, and of course, always in partnership, Sean Cronin from DLS. And all of the folks from your administration, Lieutenant Governor, just terrific to work with. There is a lot of information coming out. There's a contact with boards of health from the administration just later this afternoon regarding the changes the Lieutenant Governor referenced that will be effective September 28th. MMA will also be providing that information as it becomes available. Links on the MMA website. We'll be providing a summary of this briefing along with a link to the audio recording. When we confirm the logistics, MMA will be sending out an invitation to all of the municipal CEOs and everyone who receives this invitation for the what we think is October 1st briefing by DLS on round two of the CARES Act. And communities can share that link with, and it has to be public officials, but others in that you think in your town hall or city hall need to be invited. It could be some finance people, or it could be Board of Health people, but you can share that link and we'll get that webinar out and hosted for all of you. And then of course, in 2 weeks, on October 6th is the next briefing by the Lieutenant Governor and her team for all the municipal leaders in the Commonwealth. To all of you who have been participating and been in, quote, the audience, you are leading in your communities. We deeply appreciate what you're doing, the MMA, and we know the administration is here to support you at every turn. Thank you for your great work, and we look forward to seeing you on October 6th, if not before. Take care.
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jeff.